And I'm going to go ahead and open the public hearing on 2422. We have another housekeeping matter that we might interrupt the hearing for to take care of in a short amount of time, but there's no point in waiting on that, so we'll go ahead and get started. I'll just turn that over to you.
Madam Chair, members, House Bill 2422 increases the cigarette tax and continuously appropriates monies from the increase to the Department of Transportation for elderly and disabled transportation services. It does modify the allocation to the general fund to cities and to counties, and you will see I have provided the fiscal impact statement, which just has comments on it, but at the bottom, toward the bottom of the page, you can see how those percentages would be changing. It does apply to cigarette tax reporting periods beginning on or after the effective date, which would be on the 91st day following sine die. So we have that fiscal statement. We're still waiting for the revenue impact. Thank you.
Thank you. We'll open a public hearing, and obviously, Madam Chair, you're going to speak to us.
I am, Mr. Chair. Thank you. House Bill 2422 is a bill that I introduced for the Oregon Transit Association, which would, which at this point in time, partially funded by the cigarette tax at 2 cents is what their funding is, one of their pieces of funding. I introduced a piece of legislation that just happened to come out the day of the last day before pre-session filing. So it got introduced before we realized there was a pretty big mistake in the amount in the bill. It was supposed to be a 3 cent increase, and it appears to be about 12 cents or right around that amount. It was the bill on page 1, line 1, reads 35 mils, and it should read 30.5 mils. So it's kind of understandable. They just left off the zero and the decimal point there. So one of my intents with this piece of legislation would be to amend it to the right amount. And then at that point, we are still waiting to find out whether it goes back to revenue or ways and means. So we probably won't take action on it today. The Senior and Disabled Transportation Fund has been pretty stagnant since about 91. I mean, it's growing little bits with revenue and increases in cigarette sales and those type of things, but we really haven't added much more to it. But yet our senior population is definitely growing. Within the next decade, 15% of Oregon's total population will be over 65. Compared with 12% in 2005. And by the year 2025, one out of every five Oregonians will be over the age of 65. So it's pretty obvious that we're growing, but our the income for this population is not. The we did have a hearing last week on a bill that would require testing and relicensing of seniors. And at that point in time, it was mentioned that there are other alternatives, but I will tell you that the alternatives are not great. And better in urban areas than rural areas, but it's pretty bad in rural areas of the state. This bill, the 1 cent generates approximately 2.15 million per 1 cent increase. And in the past, in this biennium, the estimates are 8.6 million is what will come from that source of funding. There's also a what they call the lawnmower fund. Some of the funding comes from there, and that's about 6 million. And then there's the ID. The fee for the ID, anything over the cost, goes to this fund, too. And that's about almost $4 million. So So these are the amounts of money that go into it. But again, they're not really growing. There's also an administration fee for the cigarette tax. That's about $1.2 million is what it costs to administer that. So it's obviously pretty important to me that we take a look at increasing the funding for this service that we have. We certainly have lots of people here to tell us about what we have and what we need. And at this point, I am going to probably turn it over to them and come back to the dais. But if you have any questions before I come.
Questions for Representative Byer, Representative Berkeley.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair, Madam Chair. Just very quickly, given the proposal of the tobacco tax for the Children's Health Insurance Program, can you comment on how this would impact that proposal?
Well, I know that it is certainly not the intent of the people that requested this bill to impact that. I mean, they really don't want to cause any problems with that. The idea is that we certainly, as if there is money left over from what is increased, we'd certainly like to be included in that. I think it's a pretty remote possibility of getting another 3 cents on top of what they're already talking about. I don't see that as possible. But we're hoping that this is a population that's probably just as vulnerable as our children, and we should be considering that when we go forward.
Very much so. And would follow?
Up,
thank
sir.
You, Mr. Chair. Madam Chair, can you give me the total dollar amount if this should pass? How much we would have to? Do you have the total there?
I actually don't have the figures. No, I do. If this would pass and bring it up to 5 cents, the biennial total would be $21.624 million.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I had another question down here. Was it Representative Reed?
Was that Butler?
Oh, Representative Butler.
Shock. I just to follow up from a segue from Representative Buckley's question, $21.64 million is the new money generated by this bill?
No. If that would be the total. If it was raised to 5%, the amount it is now is 8.649. So the difference would be what this would generate.
Follow up,
sure.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative. Would you consider an amendment which would save harmless the cities and counties in this process, their share of the tobacco tax? There's a method whereby that can be done, and that goes back into these same kinds of services as well. Is there a way that, but at locally administered, is there a way that you would consider that amendment?
I certainly would. I know that as they were discussing the children's health plan, they were considering holding senior and disabled transportation harmless, and I think that that's something that should be considered on this too.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you, Representative Byer. Next up, Nan Heim. Nan, if you have two other people coming with you.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Thank you, Mr. Chair or Madam Chair. I'm Nan Heim, representing the Oregon Transit Association, which represents over 30 public agencies throughout the state providing transportation services. And with me are Andy Vibora from Lane Transit District and Julie Wilkie from Ride Connection in Portland. And we're all here today to express strong support for House Bill 2422 to increase funding for transportation services for the elderly and people with disabilities. And I was very excited to be asked to lead off the testimony today because I actually lobbied for the first penny that started the Special Transportation Fund 22 years ago, and also for the second penny that came in 1991. And this has been a wonderful service. You're going to hear some great stories today from people who provide these services and from people who use these services. And they have made and continue to make a tremendous difference in people's lives. It's something that I think the legislature can be very proud of. These services enable people, seniors and people with disabilities, to stay in their homes, to live independently, to go to medical appointments, shopping, et cetera. And you're going to hear some great stories. The service today is available in all 36 counties. And it's been a wonderful success story, but it faces a huge challenge. And that is, as you pointed out, Madam Chair, the population of seniors is growing so rapidly that the demand is outpacing the ability of the transit agencies to provide the service. If you look on the back of my testimony, there are some statistics, figures showing the projected growth in persons over 65 in each county of the state through 2030, and I found those figures very daunting. Services, elderly and disabled transportation services, are expensive. Many of the transit providers are developing programs to encourage people to use regular bus service, and they've had some success, but that isn't always possible. In rural Oregon, there aren't any regular bus routes, and there are some people who simply can't get to regular route bus stations. I'm not going to take up much of your time because there's so many people here who have wonderful stories to tell. We would like to show a video that was produced by Oregon Transportation Commissioner, former Oregon Transportation Commissioner John Russell, that tells the story of the Special Transportation Fund and what it does for so many Oregonians. Thank you.
For senior citizens, and some of them are in their 90s, we try to make it comfortable for them, relaxed atmosphere for them, so they're not worried and they're not concerned about if they're going to make it to their appointment on time, or if they're going to be left, or how long they have to wait.
Hello. John Kendrick. When you're 10 years old, I use the bus most of the time. When I'm coming out to Becker, mostly doctor's appointments. I have had recently doctor's appointments with my eyes, and I am gradually getting macular degeneration in my right eye, which I feel if it gets too much worse, I won't be able to drive.
In the state of Oregon, we know that we have roughly half a million people over the age of 65, and roughly 25% of those folks can't drive. We know as we look out 20 years, that number will double. There are folks with physical disabilities, vision impairments, they can't drive. So public transit, that's the way to be able to get to the grocery store, to the doctor's appointment, to their worship place, to their jobs. That's very important for those citizens.
Yeah, we're ready to get out. Curry County is another area where distances between communities are long and critical services few and far between. So residents living along Highway 101 rely on the Coastal Express, which travels 110 miles from North Bend to Brookings four times a day.
Good morning.
74-year-old Bill Dooley is a regular on the Port Orford to Brookings line.
I commute about 64 miles each way each day that I work down here, and I work down here 5 days a week in most instances. What have we found out on that 22 unit?
Bill manages Curry Public Transit, which consists of the Intercity Coastal Express and in-town on-demand vehicles. Both services run 6 days a week, and according to Bill, demand is high.
We are almost 50% population over 60 at the present time in the Brookings Harbor area. The total in the county, I have been told, runs of between 35% and 40% population over the age of 60.
Being a little bothered, I rely on Dollarize. They take me out to the beauty shop, and I call 2:30 to go home. And everybody knows that I ride it, so if I'm 5 minutes late or 10 minutes early, it's fine.
You got bill, right?
I do get bill, yes.
Our service allows them to continue to be independent far longer than they would be able to be if we were not in existence in the area. It's vitally important that these people be able to hang on, so to speak, to that independence as long as they can.
Wayne, this is exciting.
For Bob Bergman of Eugene, independence means the ability to get to work on time.
Bob's pretty miraculous young man for the difficulties that he has, I think. He's now 55 years old, so we have gone through 55 years of dealing with differences. Because he's a preemie, he had this cerebral palsy. And they've taken him for physicals, of course, and was referred to an ophthalmologist. And I suppose that that was a very landmark day, the day that I was told he was blind heart.
Today, Bob works at Oregon Research Institute. It's a job he loves and a job that benefits his community.
We've seen a transformation of Bob that's just been unbelievable. He likes to have fun. He likes to do a lot of things. And the Lane Transit District's opportunity of riding the bus has allowed him to do that.
We want them, and they want to be meaningful and productive members of society. We know that public transportation, or the lack thereof, is a great barrier to getting people to work. Thus, it's a challenge to acquire a meaningful employment.
If I didn't have the city bus, I'd be stuck at home.
Doing what?
Playing with my CB radios.
It's all a big pie we're cutting into, you know, living, working, and social. And it takes transportation to be every single one of us.
I think that you'll realize very quickly the number of people in your family probably need some kind of assistance. And where family members or friends are unable to provide that service, that's where the public transit division and our program step up to try to fill that void.
The main source of funds that's available for community transportation services are federal funds, which we can flex out of the highway appropriations, and those funds primarily are used for equipment acquisitions. We flex as much as we can. We work with the local districts to maximize our ability to stretch those funds as far as possible, but we never have enough.
It's more than tires, gasoline, and vehicles. It's a social support system that is just critical.
It just opens doors that we never would have imagined. And if we can make that happen for folks, all folks, not just folks with disabilities, then it will be a much better community.
It's good stuff.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you very much for hearing us today. Good afternoon. My name is Julie Wilkie, and I am from Ride Connection, an organization in Portland, Oregon. I've been with Ride Connection for about 6.5 years. I started my journey really in special needs transportation, volunteering for an organization that's now one of our service providers. That was back in about 92. It was shortly after my mom had passed away from Alzheimer's, and I had really personally seen the effect of limited transportation options affecting individuals' quality of life and wanted to try and make a difference. I realized then that transportation for older adults and people with disabilities is really as large a social issue as housing and food. The need for transportation crosses all ages and socioeconomic boundaries. It affects each one of us at some point in our lives. whether it be personally or with a friend or a family member or as a business owner through absenteeism. When an employee must leave work in order to drive an elderly family member to a doctor's appointment. Without adequate transportation allowing us to be mobile, our lives are profoundly affected. Today, I am here to share with you what we are doing in Washington, Clackamas, and Multnomah counties to serve older adults and people with disabilities. Components of our program relate to every area of the state. I'm going to describe what we do, but I'm really here to represent others like us throughout the state that are affected and receive funding through this source. While we serve urban areas in Portland, we also serve very rural areas in each of our three counties, Banks and Cornelius, Corbett, Eagle Creek. We are trying to provide service to as many people as possible, but we really need your help. The three points that I'd like to make today are, first of all, we are doing everything we can to be as efficient as possible. Our customers' transportation needs, as we've heard, are growing. It's growing faster than our capacity to serve them. And the third thing is that the cigarette tax is a flat and declining source of revenue. We've heard how many individuals are turning 60 each day. In addition, another statistic is that we will outlive our ability to drive normally by 7 to 10 years. In addition to these folks turning 60, we have a growing number of people that are surviving catastrophic accidents and illnesses who need special transportation. It is critical that we have transportation services in place to serve them so they can remain independent citizens in our community rather than dependent on a nursing home. We are currently not able to meet the transportation needs of our citizens. We need your help to develop stable funding that will be able to accommodate this large influx of older adults as they age. Right Connection is a nonprofit organization that's been in existence for 20 years, and we coordinate several types of transportation service through the Portland area. Last fiscal year, we provided about 358,000 rides to over 10,000 unduplicated riders. The types of rides are vital medical services such as dialysis or chemo, shopping, medical appointments, and other activities necessary to keep individuals independent and active in their own homes. Our continuum of accessible transportation services not only include rides, but also information and referral, travel training, and we support community-based services through our 30-plus community service providers who provide door-to-door trips, community shuttles. We have a shared vehicle program and also have many group trips. By offering our customers a variety of options, Ride Connection provides an older adult or a person with a disability transportation choices that suits his or her own ability level. And I wanted to share a story about a couple that I met a little over a year ago that demonstrates this. Don is 76 years old, and he'd recently been diagnosed with cataracts and was no longer able to drive. Even though his wife drove some places, they were beginning to realize that it wasn't going to be too long before they were without transportation. They live in Forest Grove, and they had seen one of our Ride Connection vehicles driving around in town and called the phone number that was on the side of the bus. Our information and referral representative talked to them about what options were available, the door-to-door service, the shopping shuttles, and also our travel training program that teaches individuals how to ride the bus. So Don and his wife really decided, though, even that they hadn't ridden the bus since 1950, that they thought that for them that would be the most independent for them, and they really wanted to give it a try and hold off on using the door-to-door until they really needed it. So Don and Sheree met with our travel trainer and started out on their new adventure. They were out with a travel trainer 2 days in a row trying to find out where they could go with that bus that stopped at the end of their street. And they told me after the first month they rode every single day just to get used to where they could go, how the service worked. The couple were really excited about their newfound freedom, and they decided that they needed to tell others in the neighborhood. So they introduced their neighbors to the idea of riding the public bus. They had been only riding into Hillsboro, but they had a doctor's appointment up at St. Vincent's and didn't really feel the that they were able or wanted to drive, continue driving to St. Vincent's. So they decided to go ahead and give the public bus a try. But Louise fell ill and had to be hospitalized. A month of treatment was to follow, and they weren't sure what to do. But Don told her about Ride Connection, and they connected Louise to our volunteer door-to-door program, where individuals would pick her up at her house, take her to her doctor's appointment, and bring her back home when she was done. So Don and Sheree didn't give up. They wanted to encourage more people to ride the bus. So they belonged to the Hillsboro Tops Club. So they talked to their Tops Club members about, that's the Taking Pounds Off Sensibly Club, about doing a group activity to a restaurant that served low-calorie, small-portion meals. So there was about 20 individuals that went that day to on the bus. They took the bus and Max into town, and every member said that they really enjoyed that day. They weren't so concerned about what to do if they could no longer drive, and that they thought that they would try it again, like maybe drive to the park and ride and then ride the bus in to get used to it before that day that they were giving up the keys. As you can see by this story, we are very efficient by coordinating existing community-based transportation so that we reduce duplication of services. We have consolidated common oversight tasks with our community providers, like the driver approval process and training, as well as vehicle acquisition. As needs change, so have we. We continually explore ways that we can be more cost-effective and feel that we have extended ourselves as far as we can without additional resources. For example, when someone calls in for a grocery trip, we strongly encourage them to join one of our existing shopping shuttles. This frees up individual rides for customers going to uncommon destinations. This past year, we experienced a 16% service increase. We increased the number of shuttles that are available throughout the region to try and meet that demand. Even though the number of rural rides has increased, which includes longer distance trips from far-reaching areas of our rural communities, our miles per trip average actually decreased. This demonstrates our success in grouping trips whenever possible, and we're very proud to say that our average cost per trip the end of last fiscal year was about $11.29 a trip. Ride Connection demonstrates a coordinated network of service options in the Tri-County area. Without Ride Connection's system stability and reliability, citizens in our area would experience fragmented transportation service. Because we offer standardization and training, because we build communication among providers, and we coordinate vehicles and funding, we maintain standards that keep our system consistent and strong. Increasing funding will allow us and others like us throughout the state to serve a growing number of older adults and people with disabilities in our communities. I looked at our turndown rate in the last 6 months, and we did have an 8% turndown rate in the consumers that are requesting rides from our service center. So we're already seeing an impact on the growing population in our area that we're serving. Census data shows that this number will only increase unless something is done. Now is the time to create a funding package that will help to carry us into the next 20 years of astronomical service increase needs. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions, or we'll just go on? Thanks.
Good afternoon, Chair Beyer and members of the committee. My name is Andy Pabora, and I'm the Director of Service Planning, Accessibility, and Marketing at Lane Transit District in Eugene. And again, we'd like to lend our strong support for House Bill 2422 and share with you a little bit of information about the services that we provide. I would note that LTD has a long history and commitment to accessible services that goes back over three decades. And in fact, LTD was one of the first transit districts in North America to become fully lift equipped on its fixed route service. So we've been very proud of that, and and continue to work with our community on developing programs that meet the needs of all of our riders. And that comes through collaborative agreements with those in our community, those human service agencies that help us in providing these services. And what I'd like to do now is touch on a couple of those programs that we call RideSource programs. RideSource, curb-to-curb service, this is our ADA complementary paratransit service that we operate in the metro area. We also offer the RideSource shopper service for once-a-week shopping trips, again, providing grocery shopping on a regular schedule and on neighborhood routes throughout our community. In addition to that, we have RideSource Escort, which is a once-a-week shopping, or excuse me, a door-to-door volunteer-based service for people who need more help than the regular RideSource curb-to-curb service offers. And this service is available primarily for medical trips, but also reaches out into the rural communities. And the reason why we are all here today is to let you know that there is a cost associated with providing these services, and they're very important services. Paratransit rides generally cost about 7 times the cost of providing that same trip on a fixed route service. A curb-to-curb ride provided through our RideSource program costs an average of about $23.50 a ride, whereas a ride on LTD's fixed route service is about $3.50 a ride. So why this discrepancy in cost? Well, on a fixed route, additional trips can be added along that route until the capacity of the bus is filled, whereas with a paratransit trip, those are individualized trips. And so we do our best, as talked about earlier, in trying to group those trips together and become as efficient as possible. But the reality is that these are individualized trips, and the best we can muster out of the system is 2 to 3 rides per hour. So LTD also encourages passengers to utilize fixed route service whenever possible, and that's really a win-win situation. It's great for the district to be able to have people use the fixed route service at these lower costs, but it's also great for the customer because there's so much more independence and flexibility in being able to use the fixed route service. Also, in order to manage our costs, we go through very stringent eligibility screening to ensure that that complementary paratransit service is there for those who need it most and who qualify for that. And so it's based on the inability to use that more cost-effective fixed route service. A couple of the innovative programs that LTD has worked on over the years I'd like to mention. From very simple things like, you know, providing hailing kits for people with visual disabilities to be able to signal bus drivers what routes they need, to a bus buddy program, which is a one-on-one orientation and training program for seniors where we match up a mentor to go out and ride with a senior who isn't familiar with riding fixed route buses. We have Lyft training. And I'm really thankful that more and more of our buses are now becoming low-floor buses with ramps, and it's just so much easier for all of our customers to use low-floor buses, and the ramps are a real benefit. But that Lyft training is so important because it gives people an opportunity to learn how to use fixed-route accessible services in an environment that's not pressure-filled and filled with that anxiety around keeping on schedule and am I doing this right or am I holding up other people on the bus. We have a transit host program, which has just proven incredibly successful. And that's a program where we can identify people who are using paratransit services who, with a little bit of extra training, can transition to fixed route bus service. And that's such a big benefit, again, for that individual who then can use fixed route buses for so many more trips. And it's also a benefit for us because then we're exchanging a $23.50 ride for a $3.50 ride. So we've been very successful in that, and we'll continue to do that. We also provide a host program at our main Eugene station. And again, these are for people who maybe need a little help transferring between buses. Maybe they, with the training, can't quite do it themselves, but with a little bit of help at the main station, can make those transfers. And so we actually have hosts that are at the station making sure that people make their connections. And by doing that, they're able to, again, stay and use fixed route transit service. So we're very, again, proud of those services and excited to continue to collaborate with the local agencies on coming up with new ways to serve this important population. Well, despite our best efforts, again, to maximize the use of fixed route, paratransit needs continue to grow. In fiscal year 2007, the tobacco tax is expected to generate for LTD about $636,000 for these paratransit services. While our general fund contribution to provide these service is budgeted at a little over $1.5 million. And last Friday, we were told that because of increased demands, that our budget for this year is going to be about $300,000 over by June 30th. So we're looking at probably a general fund transfer of over $2 million for next fiscal year to support these services that are so needed in our community. And again, the tobacco tax is flat, and so it falls upon us and our general fund to be able to offer these services in our community, which we need to do and should be doing. So LTD strongly urges the committee to support this much-needed funding in House Bill 2422, and it will provide elderly and disabled transit programs not only to Eugene Springfield but throughout the state. I thank you very much for your attention today.
Thank you. Any questions? Representative Gilman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Nan, you started this with one penny, I guess. Is that right? I want to know if you looked at other funding options. I think we're all convinced that we need to provide this service. But what other options did you look at when you first integrated it?
You mean 22 program. Years ago? Well, there are other funding sources, as I think Madam Chair mentioned to you. The driver's license, identification cards that the Department of Transportation issues, and then the lawnmower fee. But actually, the Transit Association discussed this and looked into things for about a year and a half and started talking about the cigarette tax and testifying to interim committees several months ago. So it really was before the governor proposed the tax for healthy kids.
Any other questions? Thank you. Appreciate your coming.
Thank you.
And if all of you don't mind bearing with me, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2422, and I'm going to open a work session on House Bill 2456. And since Judith is busy, if you remember this bill, it's the school bus bill. And yes.
I just noticed some people thinking that they realize that we're going to come back to this.
Thank you. And I did not make that clear. We will be coming back shortly to talk more about this issue. Yeah, go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. House Bill 2456 is the measure that prohibits the State Board of Education from allowing the use of school buses manufactured before April 1st, 1977. It provides that the operation of a prohibited school bus is a Class B traffic violation, punishable with a fine of up to $360. It would declare an emergency. The original bill was effective August 1st, 2007. We just got an amendment, the Dash 1 amendments that you now have. The only change there is instead of declaring an emergency, we're prescribing an effective date of August 1st, 2008. So it pushes it out 1 year. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. I do want to say that it's come to our attention since we first heard this bill that Wallawa is in the process of taking care of their problems. They've purchased or are purchasing three new buses. So they're okay. Enterprise is the only one left that this affects and had requested this. The sponsor of the bill was willing to give them a one-year extension in this amendment. So, Representative.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And did the Enterprise feel like that within 1 year they could then get those resources? I'm receiving an affirmative nod. And finally, the question I have is with regard to the Class B traffic violation of operating one of these buses typically will end up in other folks' hands. Will they have to be junked at that particular point, which brings a zero return back to the districts who own and who have maintained these buses, or can they be used for private and nonprofit organizations?
I do not have an Thank you. I have an expert in the audience, I hope.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Jim Green representing the Oregon School Boards Association. Representative Butler, to your question, as it relates to the Enterprise School District, they're not owned by the Enterprise School District. They're owned by a private transportation company. My conversation with Moffitt Transportation out of Enterprise, Oregon, is that they will be getting rid of the buses. They will be junking them. But in order to make it work for the Enterprise School District, they need the one-year extension. And working with Representative Hunt, he was willing to agree to this.
And follow up, then my question is, when they talk about junking the bills or junking these buses, typically what will happen is that these buses will go into private hands, not be used in public schools. Do we know where these buses will be going? They've been well maintained. I think we've seen these buses as we've traveled in the upper country. They've been well maintained, and they're being properly taken care of.
Madam Chair, Representative Butler, my understanding is from Moffitt Transportation that, I mean, they'll obviously try to sell as many as they can for scrap that they can. What they can't sell, they will junk them.
Okay, and so my question remains, Madam Chair, if there's a $360 fine for operating them, you'd have to be a damn fool or a fool at least to buy them. What is that? What's going to happen if I'm using one of these buses if I choose to buy one and take my family on vacation in it on an annual basis?
And Madam Chair, Representative Butler, maybe your committee administrator can answer. But if I read Section 2 properly, it says operated as a school bus, and those have specific terms in the statute as it relates to being a vehicle that's operated as a school bus.
Thank you. So, the fine only applies if these were used to transport school children as a school bus.
That's what the line says. Yes.
Thank you. Thank you.
Representative Smith.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Colleagues, I just want to let you know that the school board in Enterprise and Willow understand the seriousness of this issue, and they're taking it very seriously. And I want to thank Majority Leader Hunt and Mr. Green for their combined leadership in ensuring that this issue gets resolved and at the same time allowing these school districts to make the necessary adjustments they need to. And so with that, would you like me to, Madam Chair, I'd like to propose an amendment to House Bill 2456. And I think each of you have that before you. This would move the effective date 1 year forward for these two communities.
Restate that then. The proposal is to amend 2456 with the dash one amendments dated 2-2607.
That is correct. Would you like to? That was my amendment. I apologize. I should have formalized it.
Your motion.
My motion. Excuse me. I should have formalized
it. So
my motion.
Representative Smith has moved the dash one amendments to House Bill 2456 dated 2-2607. Any discussion? Hearing none, the word is gone. any objections?
Hearing and seeing none.
Hearing none. The dash one amendments are adopted.
Madam Chair. Oh, I'm sorry.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 2456 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Tomei moves House Bill 2456 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Seeing none, those of the opinion, House Bill 2456 as amendment should be reported to the floor with a due pass recommendation. We'll vote aye, and those opposed, no. And the clerk will call the roll.
Representative Buckley.
Aye.
Representative Butler.
Yes.
Representative Gilman.
Aye.
Representative Reed.
Aye.
Representative Smith.
Aye.
Representative Tomei.
Aye.
Chair Byer.
Aye. House Bill 2456, receiving the required majority, is declared passed. Do we need a carry? Representative Smith want to carry this bill? Thank you. All right, I'm going to reopen the public hearing on House Bill 2422 and call up Mark Vollmert and Nicole Palmateer.
Good
Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Mark Vollmer. I'm the Transportation Projects Coordinator for Oregon Cascades West Council of Governments and the Special Transportation Coordinator for Linn County. I presented the committee assistant with prepared remarks to save you some time. I'd like to hit just a couple of quick points. One, thank you for the existing resources in Linn County. The STF funds this year will provide 137,000 rides, including 25,000 rides to people with developmental disabilities. Some of those are provided by basic paratransit services, but some of those are provided by nonprofits and by volunteers, seniors providing rides to frail seniors and using the STF funds for some gas money. So it's well-used money. Thank you for the existing resources. The second item is that these are locally allocated funds. The local transit districts or counties or the STF agents, and they allocate the monies under the state regulations, under a thoughtful planning process, and it's a great marriage. I'd also like to thank ODOT for its efforts. 25% of this money is allocated to the Oregon Department of Transportation. In turn, it uses its discretionary grant process to take those funds and return them to local communities. Most of that money is used to leverage additional funds, particularly for Title 19 Medicaid monies to keep seniors in their existing homes and for people with developmental disabilities. And that's a 40-60 match, and ODOT provides that 40% match to obtain the 60% match. The STF funds, I think you could think of them as sort of general fund monies. They're very flexible monies, and most agencies use them to leverage federal funds. So for every dollar that you provide through STF funds, sometimes there's as many as $9 returned from federal funds. And I think that's an important, a very important part of this program. The growing needs of seniors and people with disabilities has been well documented this afternoon. Because the example that I give, if you're 75 or 80 years old and you live in a rural community or small city, you probably have frequent need to go to a larger community. Medical needs are more complex now, so the larger medical facilities. So if you drive 10 or 15 miles now and you're 75 years old, that's a pretty simple trip. It's cost effective. On the way back, you stop at the hardware store or the post office. If tomorrow, for any number of reasons, that 75 or 80-year-old person cannot drive, that trip to Springfield or Bend or Medford or Corvallis for those more complex medical facilities is very, very difficult. I request your support for House Bill 2422, and if you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer them. Thank you.
Go ahead. Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Nicole Palmatier, and I'm here on behalf of O4AD, Oregon Association of Area Agencies on Aging and Disabilities. As you're all very aware, we are the Area Agencies on Aging, serving all of your constituents all over the state, in every corner of the state. And we are here in enthusiastic support of House Bill 2422. Oregon's system of home and community-based care has really been built on the principles of independence and dignity, and that's really what we're talking about today. We talk a lot when we talk about Oregon Project Independence or family caregivers about the ability of seniors and people with disabilities to stay within their own home. But one of the very practical realities is, how are you going to get to the grocery store, and how are you going to get to your doctor appointments, and how are you going to get out and socialize, because you don't necessarily want to stay home and look at your four walls all day. Special needs transportation makes that possible. Makes it possible for somebody to be able to do those activities that we all take for granted and we find horribly inconvenient when we aren't able to do that. So we do hope that you'll support this. There is a lot of discussion this session going on about taxes and fee increases and this, that, and the other, and those are important discussions to have. We look forward to the committee looking at that in terms of Oregon seniors and people with disabilities who have a very important stake in all of this that's going on right now, and we talk about revenue. So we thank you for your consideration.
Thank you. Any questions? Seeing none, thank you. Ed Necker and Gary Boley.
Can you call?
go ahead. It's good
I
to
believe
have you.
I will. Chair Beyer, members of the committee, my name is Ed Necker, and I chair the Accessible Transportation Committee for Lane Transit District. I'm here to voice support for the Bill 2422. Now, I couldn't put the nuts and bolts of the industry any better than the previous people. We all know about the demographics of the population. We all know about the insufficiency of the, and I'm here more to put, to tell you about myself and what it's done for me. In 1991, I suffered a traumatic brain injury. I was paralyzed, couldn't speak, eat. I went through the transition from a VA hospital to a rest home to a residential care facility. The transition carried on after that, but while I was at the residential care facility, I used RideSource, which you have heard, you all know what RideSource is. I used my mother had Lou Gehrig's disease. I had come far enough that I was able to help her transfer out of bed and into a wheelchair and so forth. I used RideSource a couple of days a week to come home so my father could shop, go to the doctor and so forth. I got a form letter to all RideSource riders asking how you used the service and what it meant to you. I wrote back about my mother. Now, at that time, RideSource was coordinated out of Lane Council of Governments. Now it's LTD. But anyway, the Accessible Services Manager was so impressed with my letter that she asked me to come to a special transportation fund meeting. That was down. The first meeting I went to was in November of 96. I had to go for 4 or 5 years without a vote just to listen and be there. Now I chair the committee. The issue that's important to me, and I think should be important to all of us, is quality of life. It improved the quality of life for my mother, my father, myself. And being on that committee led me to other committees, council, boards. When I was on that committee, it didn't take me any time at all to realize that need was increasing and funding was decreasing. So I went to RideSource to see if I could volunteer. Well, I went through the committee, I went through the bosses, I went, to see if I could volunteer to do something to help. And I was used as a call taker. I took reservations, cancellations, so forth. I volunteered there for 5.5 years. It has led me to other volunteer work in the community. What started out as just a way to get me from here to there really changed my life. It made me a much more productive person. Now, today I use the regular bus, the LTD bus. I didn't require the transit host service, but it did take the Accessible Services Manager to... Well, when I was riding the RideSource buses, I was well enough to the point that I was attaching the front securements, and I was doing my own seatbelt. So Terry, the accessible services manager, said, well, now, you're doing all this for yourself. You sit on this committee. Why don't you be an example? Why don't you transfer to the regular bus? Well, I don't know why I didn't think of that myself. But I did. I'm very happy. But the bottom line is, it has started changes in my life that have changed my life considerably. The need, when talking about rides, or when I was volunteering there, 300 rides a day was a lot of rides. Now I understand they're doing 450 or 500. RideSource has an advantage because it's in the urban, it's within the LTD service boundaries. What it falls short in the SDF fund, it makes up, LTD makes up with the general fund. We don't have that option in the rural areas. When we can't give them money, and the Accessible Transportation Committee is who recommends how the SDF dollars be divided. And when we don't have enough to give to the rural agencies, they just have to do without. Anyway, need is still increasing. It's about time that funding increased the same. I thank you for the opportunity to testify, and I'm willing to answer any questions.
Yes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Schnecker, how much does it cost to ride RideSource now?
$2.50.
$2 each way?
Each way.
Very good. And can I ask one follow-up?
Yes, follow-up.
Does RideSource cover all of Lane County or just within where the regular bus routes run?
Within the LTD service boundary. It can go up to 3/4 mile outside the service boundary, but it doesn't in very many places.
Thank you.
The SDF, the 2.2 cents per pack of cigarette tax doesn't go very far.
Representative Smith.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Necker, it's great having you here. I need your help reconciling something. I feel ashamed and I feel guilty that I'm not able to contribute to the senior transporter, to the transportation needs of our most vulnerable Oregonians. Help me reconcile that.
Well, perhaps if you smoke cigarettes.
Will you join me? Representative Butler, will you join me? Help me. No. I think this is a serious issue. Help me reconcile the guilt and the shame I feel as I look around and ask how many of you are contributing to this most worthy cause. I think the cause is worthy. I'm there. I'll write my check right now. How many of you will also write your check? This part I'm struggling with, and I need your help. And the reason I'm asking you is because you're the chair of a transportation district. Why should not this be funded by all Oregonians when it affects all Oregonians? I'm ashamed.
That's a good question.
Thought I'd ask it.
So far, we have never been able to receive dedication from the general fund. Right now, I feel we are fortunate that 2.2 cents per cigarette pack is allocated to us. And, you know, it may be a fluctuating source of income, but at least it is a source of income.
My question, although directed at you, is directed at this committee. We ought to look in the mirror and look at ourselves and say, if this is worthy of funding, then every Oregonian ought to take responsibility for the funding of this.
and I'll be the first one in line to write my check.
Well, if we could come up with a figure that a 5-cent increase in cigarette tax would generate and produce that amount of funding from the general fund, that would be acceptable.
I'd be more inclined, Madam Chair, just one last thought. I'd be more inclined to fund alcohol so at least that way we can give drives to the drunks. Well, I mean, I'm just being very candid with you. To me, I see more of a correlation with alcohol than I do with tobacco, and I feel ashamed that I'm not allowed to contribute to this worthy cause. So that's my thought.
Thank you. Other questions?
I'm sorry. I can't take away your shame.
I do have one comment on Representative Smith's issue with the cigarette tax, and I think you're right. I think this is something that, I mean, we all should be paying for because eventually we'll probably all need it. And that is one of the reasons that we're in the cigarette tax game at this point is trying to find something that is ongoing and somewhat sustainable. And anytime we put you in the general fund, it does not guarantee you're going to stay there. It does not guarantee funding. At least the way this is set up, there is an income coming in. And so that's the reason they're there, whether it's the right one or not. I mean, that is the reason.
Yeah, so. I'm a dedicated supporter of Senior and Disabled Services and O4AD, and they seem to be some of the first services that are cut when budgets are falling short. And I'm sure that special transportation would be no different.
Thank you. Seeing no other questions, I thank you so much for coming. It is quite the example for all of us legislators in Lane County. We can only strive to be.
Well, I was told a long time ago that one of the most important things to do when you come to Salem is to put a face on it.
Thank you.
So that's what I tried.
Thank you. And I had called Gary Foley, and I hope he didn't disappear when I recessed us for a little bit. How about Eddie? I'm going to butcher her name. Fluoride?
Fluoride.
And Catherine Wheel.
Members of the committee, for the record, my name is Catherine White, and I'm here on behalf, I know my handwriting is
good.
I'm here on behalf of the Oregon DD Coalition, which is a coalition of 26 organizations, including self-advocates, families, providers, who care about issues around developmental disabilities. And I'm going to make my comments very, very brief. Transportation, special transportation for people with developmental disabilities always rises to the top in every survey that we have done over the last 10 years. As more people with developmental disabilities live in the community, grow up in their communities, seek to have jobs, transportation becomes the major barrier for their involvement in the community, employment, social relationships. I think a lot has been said already, and you understand the issue. I'd like you to hear from Eddie to talk a little bit more about what it means to self-advocates and individuals with developmental disabilities.
Thank you. If you want to go ahead and identify yourself.
Okay.
Thank you.
My name is Eddie Plurd. I'm Edward Plurd. I live at 1025 Park Avenue, Northeast Salem, Oregon. It is important for people with developmental disabilities to get to doctor's appointments and all that, and get to appointments and and out in the community with their friends and all that. It is important to me to get around in the community. And that's all I have to say. And self-advocates as leaders, I'm involved in. I'm the chair of self-advocates as leaders. And we wrote a statement. Our staff wrote a statement about it and had emails from other self-advocates as well. And I'm in support of the House Bill 2422.
Any questions? Not seeing any. Thank you so much for coming in today. We really appreciate having you. John Charles and Charlie Morris, if you come up together.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is John Charles. I'm president of Cascade Policy Institute, which is a free market research center based in Portland. And we promote policies based on the principles of individual liberty, economic opportunity, and personal responsibility. And one of the challenges of carrying out our mission is that sometimes standing up for individual liberty can be difficult. And in this case, it is, because the cause here is just. The transit cause, but the method of finance is not. So that raised the dilemma, and I kind of want to focus on that a little bit and offer a suggestion. And the biggest problem with this is the moral hazard raised with this, or any, actually, syntax, as they're known generically. Typically, the reason to tax tobacco is to discourage consumption. And assuming for the moment that it's appropriate for the government to intervene in what adults choose to purchase, at least you can say at the end of the day, if consumption goes down, you're accomplishing what most parents and grandparents would like, which is that their kids don't take up smoking. And I'm not a smoker, and I support that message. But once you tax that product, and instead of putting it in some escrow account, you actually dedicate it to specific programs, as we do here with cities, counties, and transit districts and others, all relying on it for essential services, well, then you're not trying to suppress that activity. You're clearly encouraging it. Essentially, the state of Oregon now already is, and will be much worse under this bill and the health care bill, the major shareholders in tobacco companies. In fact, even worse, because at least shareholders bear some risk of losing money. They actually have to produce a product and sell it, and they can lose money. With an excise tax, it's pure profit. No risk, all profit. And I was lobbying here about 20 years ago when there was a big debate over apartheid in South Africa and whether to disinvest. Very passionate, multi-hour long debate. And as I recall, in fact, the state of Oregon, the Oregon Investment Council, was directed to take its investments out of South Africa to vote with their values to not support apartheid. Well, here, I'm just sort of wondering how many legislators would vote to direct the Oregon Investment Council with their PERS investments to specifically buy up large blocks of stock in tobacco companies to express our support for how much we need people to buy tobacco to prop up our various programs. I seriously doubt that the legislature would actually do that, though every time you increase tobacco tax for something other than tobacco cessation or something that might actually benefit tobacco users, which is a tiny, tiny part of where the money goes, that's what you're doing. To me, that is immoral. Other unintended consequences of this, of course, is that smokers are disproportionately poor, disproportionately low income, and from minority backgrounds, and so they are least able to defend themselves from the predations of tax imposition. And the more you do this, the more you invite smuggling and black market activities, which is not a trivial matter. In New York City, which has one of the highest taxes in the country on tobacco, during 2005, there were 4 known homicides related to the illicit activity in tobacco smuggling. So you encourage a prohibition-style problem with this. So I would just conclude by saying that, echoing the comments that Representative Smith has made, if paying for transit is worth doing, then it's worth doing with general fund money. And you should not promote one social policy by imposing an unjust tax on a small segment of the population. And so one of the things it seems to me you could do, it's completely counterintuitive, I know, but instead of incrementally increasing the tax and the allocation for transit, you could amend the bill to zero out the use of tobacco taxes for transit. And then when the bill has to go to revenue, presumably, you march down en masse and you make a case in front of the Revenue Committee as to why we need to stop being major shareholders in tobacco. And then if it goes to Ways and Means for the argument of how the general fund pays for this, fine. Then you go en masse to Ways and Means and you argue on behalf of all the people sitting here who need their services. And then you're standing on the moral high ground. You're saying the cause is just and the finance mechanism is also just. And I believe that is the solution to the problem. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions? Representative Buckley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Chair, I just have a kind of comment that will lead into a question. I'd love to be morally pure, but I'm much more interested in getting these people transportation. Are you aware that every time a state has increased tobacco taxes, it has not only served to reduce tobacco smoking among youth and people of need, has also reduced the cost of health care to the state? If there is a morally pure tax that you can back, and that you will go with me to the state of Oregon and say, let's increase this morally pure tax to give these people transportation or provide health care for our kids or provide a decent education for our kids, if you know of that morally pure tax, I will campaign with you across the state for that, given the idea that you will actually ask for an increase of revenue to take care of the needs of the people of our state. I'm rather pushed over the edge by the idea that we are somehow doing something that's morally impure by trying to take care of the people of our state. And all I can say to you is, and please respond any way you want to, I'll take care of the people of the state any way I possibly can, and I'll leave the moral purity to others. Thank you.
Well, I will respond briefly. That argument can be used on behalf of suppressing people's free speech. A little censorship here because you oppose that, and a little censorship there because you oppose that, and pretty soon, who's left to defend your free speech rights after you've censored everybody? So I say what I said before. If you actually move to repeal this and to move it to a general fund argument, I would, in fact, show up in front of Revenue and Ways and Means and say the same thing I've said now.
And would you join with me in asking the people of Oregon for more of their income tax revenue to pay for this thing?
Madam Chair and Representative Buckley, that would depend on knowing all the things asking for general fund revenue and knowing whether that's necessary. I don't have that knowledge, so I can't say.
I am not on Ways and Means, but I have that knowledge just by being an Oregonian of knowing what the needs of our state are, with over 100,000 people without health, 600,000 people without health insurance, with kids out to be able to get a decent day, decent education in our school districts. I know what the needs of our state are.
Representative Butler.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think that Mr. Charles would agree with his economic background that you discourage, you tax that which you wish to discourage. And certainly by taxing tobacco, you want to discourage the use of it. But I guess my question to you, John, would be, and it's probably founded in state constitution somewhere, is there some portion of other transportation's monies, and the chair alluded to some that might be available, that could be tapped in to take care of these very worthy needs without continuing to encourage the use of tobacco consumption in order to support a very worthy need?
Madam Chair, Representative Butler, that raises an interesting question, and I have thought about that as a longtime transit rider and activist. I helped the city of Sandy opt out of TriMet back in 1999, 2000, and I serve on their Transit Advisory Committee to this day, dealing with these issues. One of the problems is we artificially suppress the actual market price of transit to an extremely low level, assuming that everybody has to be subsidized when, in fact, demographically, many transit users of all transit services are quite capable of paying much more than the $1 or $2 that they pay. And not just young people, many retirees like my parents who need those services, they've saved all their lives. They can afford more than a dollar or two. So you could means test transit of all types, not just the transit here, but the transit that TriMet runs or Lane County Transit, and identify people, self-identify those who need the help, and help them specifically, as we do with many other entitlement programs, help them and have other people whose incomes are high pay more of the freight for daily, day-to-day transit services. And certainly in TriMet, the demographics of who rides rail, which they spend a lot of money on, is overwhelmingly, it's an upper-income demographic, and yet they're being actually subsidized in some kind of reverse Robin Hood scheme by other lower-income people. That could be remedied if you wanted to go down that path.
Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Morris?
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Excuse me. My name is Charlie Morris. I'm a volunteer driver for the Red Cross Transportation Department, working through Ride Connection. And I've really enjoyed my job. I've been with it 15 and a half years. I do it one day a week. And I feel that if I get 100 miles during the daytime, that one particular day, that I've really contributed something to the program, which most generally, yesterday I did 130 miles in 9 hours. But anyway, so in my 15 years that I've been, I've encountered a lot of people and their aches and pains, or more than aches and pains. I have aches and pains, and I see their problems, and I thought, wow, this is just like a bump in the road for me. But anyway, so just Tuesday I transported a gentleman. His wife had a massive stroke 2 years ago, so she's in a care facility 15 miles away from where he lives. So I pick him up in his wheelchair, transport him there. He stays with his wife for a couple, 3 hours, and then I come back to get him. Sometimes I come back, she's asleep and he's asleep. And but so after I get him in the vehicle, I says, well, how did your visit go with your wife today? And he says, well, she didn't have much to say, but I was still able to be there with her. And to move along, and then we have a Chinese lady that we take to an Asian health center who goes over there for lunch and is able to communicate with other people in her native tongue. And so when she comes home after a couple hours, you know, she really feels uplifted. You can just tell by the way she feels. And then I've transported a lady who had a complete knee replacement. First of all, she had to go to physical therapy, and then now she's doing water therapy. And so if we didn't have this transportation, she would be kind of up a creek, you might say. Her husband not able to drive. And also we've transported a lady who has to go to dialysis 3 times a week. So she's not able to get there. So that's one of the people. And then we've transport another lady who goes to chemotherapy for radiation. And there's just so many different stories that I could come up with during that course of time. And then last of all, then there's just the regular doctor's visits that they go to. And this two ladies, there's an elderly mother and a middle-aged daughter, and they're constantly yelling at each other. And I thought, wow, I'm sure glad that I'm transporting today, because I hate to have them out in the street in their own car doing this. So, anyway, to Mr. Representative Smith, if in the meantime, if you want to do something, you know, the Red Cross is always looking for volunteer drivers. So that's all I have, but that's just, I strongly recommend the adoption of 2422, just because of all the people that I have, you know, seen and how we've helped. And some of the clients will say, boy, I sure love your service, but, you know, I got to go someplace tomorrow and they're not able to take me. And I said, well, you know, we're all volunteer drivers. If somebody decides to take off to the sunny country, you know, it kind of leaves them in a bind. Or if we just get overbooked. So So if, you know, we could have more transportation available, if we could have some kind of a program to encourage more people to try and volunteer for drivers. I don't know what it is. I've talked to a lot of people, and they say, no, I don't want to do that. And, I mean, I live in Portland, so maybe they feel, well, I don't want to fight the city traffic. I just don't know. But anyway, but I thank you very much for listening to my spiel. And
thank you. Any questions? He probably has a form if you want to sign up.
Madam Chair, I am a man who puts his actions where his words are. You send me a contribution slip, I will make sure you get a generous contribution, a personal contribution from Greg Smith. You send me the form. Madam Chair, how many of you, else of you are going to join me? There's two.
Thank you.
Three, four. Representative Reed. There we go.
Okay.
Representative Tomei, will you join us in contributing to the Red Cross?
I always do.
There we go. My job is done today.
Thank you so much. And that was all I had signed up. Is there anyone who... I appreciate you all coming today. I'm going to close the public hearing on 2422, and hopefully we'll be able to do something with this bill. So thank you for coming. And I want to open the public hearing on House Bill 2704.
Madam Chair, just one question, and
yes.
Without reopening that other. Will that bill have a subsequent referral back to Ways and Means or back to Revenue?
It will have a subsequent referral. We're waiting right now to figure out which one.
Thank you. There's an elasticity question that we'll have.
Yes. And with your suggestion on the amendment,
I can help with those amendments because I help them. Pardon me? I've done it now for three sessions. So trying to protect the local transit districts and the cities and the counties.
Representative Cannon, we're ready for you.
Well, I like this room on this side of the dais. We're at a level. This is good.
You can get your knees under that.
Yeah. That's great.
We're not at the level with you.
No, of course. Shall I begin?
Yes, you may begin.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Ben Cannon. I'm State Representative for District 46 in Southeast and parts of Northeast Portland. Thank you very much for the opportunity to testify today, and particularly to the Chair for her willingness to hear this bill. And I also want to thank the Department of Motor Vehicles and ODOT for their cooperation in working with me on this issue. This is an important topic that deserves some close consideration by your committee. I want to start with a brief overview of the House Bill 2704 before describing some of the reasons that I believe this topic to be so important. House Bill 2704 deals with subjects that the Department of Transportation must include on its written or, I believe, computerized test of applicants for driver's licenses. Under current statute, the department is already required to test applicants' knowledge of the rights of blind pedestrians, the meaning of traffic signals and signs, the proper operating procedure in emergency, vehicle safety equipment in use, and practices necessary for safe operation of a vehicle around pedestrians and bicyclists. They're not limited to those topics, but they are required to test those topics. House Bill 2704 simply adds, as you'll see, the line fuel-efficient driving techniques to this list. This is a simple change with large ramifications. Let me give you some idea of what I have in mind when I describe fuel-efficient driving techniques. These are small, simple steps that will improve the gas mileage of some drivers by as much as 50%. So say that again. These are steps that drivers can take to improve their gas mileage by as much as 50%. They include the following. One, simply observing the speed limit. While each vehicle reaches optimum fuel efficiency at different speeds, gas mileage usually decreases rapidly once you go past 60 miles per hour. And as a rule of thumb, drivers can assume that each 5 miles per hour they go above the 60 mile per hour limit is like paying an additional 20 cents per gallon at their gas. Fill up because of the lost fuel efficiency above 60 miles an hour. Number two, avoiding excessive idling. Idling gets, of course, 0 miles per gallon. Folks would recommend that we forgo idling at the curb while waiting or running a quick errand. Removing excessive weight from the car, using cruise control, using overdrive gears, doing regular maintenance to your car, all of these steps combined can improve fuel efficiency significantly. Passage of this bill would ensure that these techniques, or similar ones devised by the department, the statute does not specify which they would be required to test, would end up in the hands of every prospective Oregon driver through their inclusion in the driver's manual and on written tests for licenses. This bill is about saving money, improving the environment, and reducing America's dependence on foreign oil. And just to leave you with this statistic, U.S. drivers spend $292 billion annually on fuel, 60% of which originates in foreign countries. If American drivers increased their fuel efficiency by 15%, just 15%, which is well within what's achievable if we all follow these techniques, we could cut our foreign imports of oil by nearly a billion barrels per year. So this has potentially huge, of course that's nationwide, but quite significant consequences. I served this session as vice chair of the Energy and Environment Committee, and I've heard a lot of testimony already about initiatives to move towards cleaner sources of fuel and power. And I'm excited about those initiatives, the biofuels package that we'll hear on the House floor tomorrow, and other incentives that will pass this session, I hope, to promote renewable resources. But as I've listened in that committee, it has been abundantly clear that the single most effective, cheapest, and easiest step we can take to combat global warming and a host of other environmental problems is conservation. It is the starting place for environmental stewardship. The beauty of the approach proposed in this bill is that it uses education to help Oregonians save money at the gas tank and help save America from our addiction to oil. My understanding is that DMV can make this addition voluntarily, and I appreciate their willingness to work with me to do so. Jack Evans from ODOT's been helpful and has signaled their willingness to do so. I guess I would encourage us to go the statutory route because I think a statute says a lot about our values and priorities as a society, and will also ensure that they do add this to the test and then accordingly to the manual. So with that, I'll conclude, and I'd be happy to take any questions.
Representative Butler.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Cannon, thank you very much. I just want to make sure that I'm understanding what you say. If I reduce the driving of my car at an average of probably 70 plus miles an hour as I travel back and forth to eastern Oregon, if I were to drop that by 10 miles per hour so that I would spend roughly an extra hour on the road as I'm heading back and forth, if I drop that by 10 miles per hour, that I would actually save about one-fifth of a tank of gas?
Madam Chair, Representative Butler, it does depend on what vehicle you're driving. These numbers price differently for different vehicles depending on their fuel economy, but yes, estimates would suggest that you may save as much as one-fifth or 40 cents per gallon, or I understand you take 40 cents into the current price of gas and approximately 20% on fuel efficiency. That is the estimate that I've read.
Further follow-up, thank you, Madam Chair. But it's my understanding that the DMV can already endorse, encourage, and include this kind of information into the book. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, Representative Butler, that is correct. DMV can, as I understand it, add whatever they want to the book. perhaps also to the test, although I'm less clear about that. I just reiterate my belief that I think the statute says something about what we are prioritizing in our society and in our driving, and it, of course, would ensure that they do include this in the test and then also in the manual.
And finally, Madam Chair,
yes,
just observation, no response required. I guess I'm finding it. First of all, a driver's manual will encourage you to use cruise control. Driver's manual will encourage you to use regular scheduled maintenance on your vehicle. But I'm really anxious about including things that we should do for common sense in our in our overall driver's manual. The kinds of things that, you know, don't drive with the don't drive your truck with a piece of furniture straight up and down in the back with all of that wind current against it. I mean, those kinds of common sense kinds of things outside of what the manual, the driver, or not the driver's manual, but the owner's manual is already saying. I'm not sure at what point we move from being good stewards of the government and governance into a situation where we really become, you know, the mothers of all of the drivers that are out there. I'm just anxious about that approach. Thank you.
Any other questions? Seeing none. Yep. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Let's see.
Representative Gilman.
Joe Smith.
Representative Gilman?
Yes.
Is it our deodorant? Is that the problem, or is it our aftershave lotion?
I don't think so. No,
oh, okay.
I don't think so.
All right.
Welcome, Joe.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair, Mr. Committee. I'm Joe Smith, Portland, Oregon, and I'm here representing myself, and I am absolutely delighted that this bill is a bill. And I want to tell you a short story. 35 years ago, this coming summer, I was at a reception and falling into conversation with a couple who, in those days, we would have described as limousine liberals. They were very well-to-do, but they had very high social conscience and a very high... And that was kind of the birth of when conservation and environmentalism was becoming something in the political consciousness and becoming issues. And they were expressing views very much supportive of our need to do that sort of thing. And I said, well, you, of course, got that from your parents. And she said, no, my parents were not conservationists. And I said, turn off the lights. Don't leave the water running. Don't waste your food. Let's try to fix it before we buy a new one. Are those things you recognize? And you could have seen the light bulb come on over her head, and she realized that the consciousness that she had of the necessity for our behavior being modified to conserve and to turn things over to the next generation as good as we found them came not because they were saying, you must be environmentalist, but they came because those simple principles were inculcated her as she grew up. Representative Cannon has given you the figures. A figure that you can bank. You can bank that an average of 15% is conservative. Conservative as to what would be saved if people became truly conscious of simple things that you can do, like not accelerating more rapidly than is necessary, like anticipating when you see a light that you obviously are going to have to stop for, start slowing down now, not driving excessively over the speed limit, simple things that can be done. And what I submit that in even perhaps more important than that 15% that you can bank is over time the consciousness, the awareness, as that high school kid is learning to drive and has to learn, you know, if you, what is the cutoff time for your vehicle as to when it is most advantageous to turn it off as to oppose letting it idle. Difference from vehicle to vehicle, that kind of information can be provided. What is the penalty for your, what is the optimum speed for your vehicle to gain the best gas mileage? That kind of thing can be provided. And the awareness of having to learn that is going to have an effect on behavior, just as that couple's behavior was modified there by their parents who said, don't leave the lights on, make sure the water isn't dripping, let's try to fix it before we buy a new one. Be glad to answer any questions.
Thank you. Questions? No. Thank you. I'm sorry our committee has thinned out a little bit. Jeremiah Bauman, Lindsay Capps, and want to come up? And we need to be out of this room by 5, but that doesn't mean I want you to take all the time. Go ahead.
I was going to say, I don't think we need nearly that much time.
Oh, good.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Jeremiah Bauman. I am an environmental advocate with the Oregon State Public Interest Research Group, or OSPIRG. I'll say the caveat to start off with, I'll agree with Mr. Smith that I don't think energy conservation is the province of limousine liberals. Well, a lot of people might call me a liberal. I come from a cattle ranching family in Montana that's also very conscious about our gas consumption. The main reason that OSPIRG supports this bill is that our country and our state are simply too dependent on oil. Whether you define that problem as a dependence on foreign sources of energy that keep us tied to volatile regions of the world that I don't think we want to be tied to, whether you define that problem as global warming and the threat that that holds for the snowpack that feeds our rivers and our farm irrigation and our hydropower system, or whether you define that problem as the rising gas prices that are making it harder and harder for Oregonians to afford a tank of gas, it's a big problem, and a problem that we need to address head on. As policymakers, there are two primary strategies for addressing oil consumption. One is to encourage the use of alternative and renewable fuels, which this legislative session is already doing quite aggressively with our biofuels package. And the second is to reduce the amount of oil that we consume. Unfortunately, it's relatively difficult at the state level to reduce the amount of oil we consume in a straightforward way. The most effective way historically has been to simply make cars that go farther on a gallon of gas. The National Academy of Sciences, among others, has found that right now automakers have the technology to get cars going about 15 miles per gallon better than the current average within the next 4 or 5 years. Unfortunately, the federal government has reserved the right and withheld it from the states for putting any place any kind of controls on gas mileage. I'm also guessing that probably wouldn't be a very controversy-free issue in this legislature, even if we didn't have the authority to go there. What I do hope is less controversial is the idea that we can use simple steps to educate Oregonians about ways they can get better gas mileage just through the way that they drive. I also would share some of Representative Butler's concern that we think that we're going to be able to micromanage the way people drive and get the state in the business of telling people how to go about doing their business. But I think that Representative Cannon has come up with a very straightforward, simple, and effective way to use a tool that the state already uses to educate drivers, about one more important opportunity, and that's to save gas. To save gas so they save money at the pump, to save gas to cut down on the environmental impacts of oil consumption, and to save gas to cut our ties to unstable countries from where we get our oil. So I think this is, in short, a almost brilliantly simple idea that could go a long way towards helping Oregonians save money and help our environment at the same time. And I would strongly urge the committee to support this bill. Thank you.
Thank you. Go ahead.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Lindsay Capps, Legislative Director for the Oregon Environmental Council and a recovering lead foot, for that matter. The Oregon Environmental Council supports HB 2704, providing vehicle owners training in fuel-efficient driving practices makes sense and it's cost-effective. It will save Oregonians money, conserve fuel, reducing our dependence on foreign oil, as Representative Cannon discussed, and curb global warming pollution from cars and trucks. Federal CAFE standards have certainly been an effective tool for energy conservation. They increased new car and truck fuel economy by 70% between 1975 and 1988. In 2000 alone, cafes saved American consumers $92 billion, reduced oil use by 60 billion gallons of gasoline, and kept 720 million tons of global warming pollution out of our atmosphere. While increasing fuel economy standards for vehicles will obviously create the most significant energy savings and reductions in pollutants, individuals can and should contribute to more conservation using efficient driving techniques. Studies have shown that 1 year after taking fuel economy training courses, trained drivers achieve an estimated 10 to 25% improvement in fuel efficiency. This not only benefits these drivers in saving on fuel and reducing wear and tear on their vehicles, which obviously reduces maintenance costs, but it can help considerably in cutting down on greenhouse gas emissions, since according to the Union of Concerned Scientists, approximately 24 pounds of global warming pollutants are released into the air for every gallon of gasoline that's consumed. So that's considerable. Many in the private sector, notably fleet operators and many in Oregon, have long recognized the value of promoting fuel economy as part of their safe driver training for commercial drivers. Truck manufacturers as well, like Daimler Chrysler, for example, have offered fuel economy training as part of their safe driving courses for commercial drivers since as early as 1968, and they've done it in about 48 countries. And so there's really no reason in our mind why we couldn't do the same for passenger car drivers in our state. There are many, obviously, online resources that promote fuel-efficient driving, but we believe that DMV is the most direct route to enable Oregonians to master these techniques and improve the efficiency of their driving. So we think this is a good bill. We strongly support it. We urge its passage, and we obviously thank the distinguished members of this committee for your consideration. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions here? No? Okay, thanks. And we have one more. Jack?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Jack Evans with the Department of Transportation, here to talk to House Bill 2704, which would require ODOT to include fuel-efficient driving techniques in the exam for the driver's license. We have had discussions with Representative Cannon about this idea. We think it's a real good idea. We plan to work with him on developing some additional information for the manual and to create some test questions for the driver examination. We don't need a statutory change to do this. To add a question to the test, it simply has to be in the manual that individuals are given to study. And it's not necessary to identify a topic in statute that goes into that manual. And this has been a long-standing interpretation. We've added a number of items, both to the manual and to the test, that aren't necessarily mentioned in statute. There are some mandatory domains that each test has to include, and those were mentioned by the representative, the blind pedestrian rights and traffic signs and signals, and those different categories have to be on every test. Right now we have a test that includes 35 questions that are randomly selected from a pool of a couple hundred potential questions, and these are generated every time somebody comes in to take an examination. This bill would mandate that the question regarding fuel-efficient driving, one of those questions, be on every single exam. If we don't have that in the statute, what we plan to do is to go ahead and put this in and work with the representative, put this information into the manual, and to create some questions to put them into the pool, and then as these examinations are generated, to draw that question out in a random fashion. It's estimated that if we did it in that way, we'd probably get a question at least one in three tests that deal with this. And that may or may not be your desire, but I think we're feeling that that would accomplish the result that people would know that this is an important area. It's in the driver's manual, and you need to study this in order to take the test, so we feel we'll be accomplishing that. But either way, with or without this statute, we're looking forward to working with Representative Cannon in adding this material to the manual and to create some of these test questions.
Any questions? I guess what I heard, and well, we'll have to figure out what we're going to do, but it's not necessary. You can do this without the bill. It's just that with the bill, it would be on every test as opposed to in the pool. Is that what you said?
Chair Beyer, that's correct. It would be we'd create the information in the manual and then create a number of questions that would be added to the pool. And then as each 35-question examination is generated when somebody comes in, we're estimating that it would be a 1 in 3 chance of that getting in there versus having it mandated in statute that it be a question on each and every examination.
Okay. Any other? Representative Butler.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So, Jack, you're telling us that you have the ability to do it, you think it's a great idea, nothing precluding you from doing it right now. That can be done administratively, and that's an administrative rule, or how do you propose that would happen?
Chair Beyer, Representative Butler, I'm not sure that involves the rulemaking process. I think what they do is they would begin in the summer to put this information together as a policy, and I'll check on that to see if it is rulemaking. But they work with the representative in probably the late summer, put together the questions and the material, and then have that published around the first of the year.
Madam Chair, I'm still anxious. A lot of this revolves around good common sense, and the other testifier was absolutely correct. You know, you learn a lot of this at your mother's knee. I frequently tell folks, my goodness, my wholesomeness, my honesty and integrity, I learned at my mother's knee. All the rest of my attributes I picked up at some other joint.
Thank you, Representative Butler. And we won't ask where. All right. Seeing no other, we'll go ahead and close the public hearing on House Bill 2704. And we will adjourn for the day. And no meeting on Friday.